Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. When the world's economy showed signs of trouble in 2007, central bankers around the world, the people responsible for monetary policy, responded. But what they did during and after the crisis ended up pumping money into big banks, shielding them from the crisis, and leaving ordinary people behind. The open door between private and central banking allowed asset bubbles to grow unchecked, ripe for another crisis. In her new book, Collusion, How Central Bankers Rigged the World, former investment banker Nomi Prins explains how the Federal Reserve nudged central banks around the world to infuse banks with fabricated money at the expense of the real economy. She argues that no significant regulations have been introduced to fix the structural problems left behind after the financial crisis, and that means we're headed for another epic fail. She says the question is not if, but when. Nomi Prins joins us from Washington, D.C. Hi, Nomi. Welcome back to the show.
Thank you so much, Rose.
Well, it's great to have you, Nomi, and you've talked about this before, but I just want to remind listeners, you have a very interesting background because you worked at three of the largest investment banks, the now defunct Lehman Brothers, Bear Stearns, and Goldman Sachs. Why did you decide to get into investment banking in the first place?
Well, actually, that would be the fourth bank, which is now a conglomerate, which is J.P. Morgan Chase. But at the time that I joined, it was Chase, which was before Lehman Brothers. So it was kind of a old school commercial bank at the time I joined it. It was a place that had a lot of emphasis on things like taking in people's deposits and providing loans, and it did that for corporations as well. And it was just starting to get involved in some more esoteric types of trading, but it was well behind some of the investment banks at the time that were sort of moving more increasingly forward in terms of their more complex types of transactions. And really, I got into Chase because I wanted to move to New York City. It was really that simple. I was finishing school. University just outside, and I wanted to be in the city. I got a degree in math, and they were looking for programmers to sort of change old systems into new ones, and so that's really how I came into banking. It wasn't sort of a long held prior notion. I didn't even have a checking account at the time.
So. Did you know much about how the banking world worked at that time?
I knew absolutely zero about how the banking. I hadn't even taken a course in any of that. But the thing was at the time, the math of banking is actually consistent with what it was then when I joined to what it has become. It's just again more complex. But it's the idea of looking at interest rates coming in on certain types of loans or bonds or other types of securities, and looking at how much money is coming into the bank and how much money they can make by using it internally and externally in manifesting it in different ways. That's just becoming on steroids type of business. But there was always a kind of similarity in the math of banking. Now, what has also changed over those years is the avarice of banking. It isn't so much that bankers weren't making money back then. It's just that the difference between what they made back then to real people, and I started at the same salary as anyone working in sort of any company advertising or anything else in New York at the time, but it's really ballooned well beyond that because the amount of money that can be taken out as the banking industry is consolidated and the power and assets that the biggest banks hold has grown by so much relative to other size banks, it's just become a much more powerful force. And in that power, there's a lot of influence in Washington, there's a lot of control over the markets, and there's control over emergency situations that banks cause and how they get help to come out of them fine.
Mm. You write about what happened in New York in 2000 when you were a managing director at Goldman Sachs. You were responsible for the analytics underlying a rapidly evolving product, credit derivatives. A lot of us learned about that for the first time during the crash. You write that you ran a SWAT team that, quote, hunted for white elephant transactions tailored especially for major financial clients and corporations. And the internal pressures within the firm regarding that hunt were intense. Wall Street had become less focused on client risk as products, and it became more complicated and lucrative. You say that one senior manager advised you that if you wanted to get ahead at Goldman, you had to make upper management your clients, not external customers. You say that that was a pivotal moment for you. Why was that?
Because through the years before that, there was a semblance of the work that we were doing, helping our customers, and that was the one-to-one relationship. And yes, there was always the sense of trying to make money along the way, or being required to make money along the way, and extracting more and more along the way by creating more complex types of transactions with customers. But it really became, no, we're not really concerned about them. We are concerned simply about us. And that meant that the long-term relationships with certain customers also took a backseat. And we saw that ultimately, what you're saying, the sort of advice I was given by a senior manager at the firm at the time at Goldman Sachs before I left, about making the senior management clients and not real clients, pretty much was what the world saw in the wake of the financial crisis of 2008 with Goldman Sachs and other companies. Goldman Sachs, of course, had to settle for $550 million, among other settlements that came out of the crisis of 2008, because they had effectively front-run or bet against their clients or some of their clients in order to really make money out of others of their clients. And that was the way in which they did that was considered to be fraudulent, and they wound up paying a fine. They didn't really pay a fine that was commensurate with what they made at the time, but they certainly did have to cop to that sort of front running of clients. So what I was experiencing a few years before that became the experience of the world looking at these types of firms a number of years after.
A lot of the system can be very complicated. A lot of people don't understand even what a central bank is. Why is the word central there? Or how the Federal Reserve works, or how these relationships work. Because you look at the history of banking, talk a little bit about how the function of banks have really changed. Because, you know, back in the 70s and the 80s, when people put their savings just in a bank, the interest rate was actually pretty high. You had a pretty nice return with money just in a savings account, and that is not the case anymore. And then when you look at what happened when Glass-Steagall was overturned under Bill Clinton in 1999, that really changed the function of a bank. So if you can talk in layman's terms just about how the function of banking has really changed over the past couple decades.
Yeah, so what happened was around the 70s, banks had this shift in their management. So the major banks of the United States, particularly like J.P. Morgan, Chase, Citigroup, and so forth, they're pretty much run by a group of families, really, that had created them about 100 or so years before that. And what wound up happening was the there was a social responsibility, even though some of these people were very rich bankers like J.P. Morgan and the Rockefellers and so forth, that somehow had to integrate with the moving forward of the country as a whole. So though they were sort of elite and had the privy of experiencing one-to-one meetings and relationships and yachting and so forth with presidents, they also had a sense that their banks would be part of the sort of growth of the overall country. And that really did shift for a couple reasons in the 70s and 80s. One of the reasons was that the oil money that was coming out of the Middle East, this is a longer story, but basically enabled banks to find a new source of money, of petrodollars, and convert that into loans to Latin American countries. So rather than sort of being connected to the presidency and the sort of central elements of their own countries here or in other countries, they found a new way to have an extra source of capital. And whenever banks have an extra source of capital, they both use it, and they want less restrictions as to how they use it. And the less restrictions they have, the less restrictions they want to have in the future. And so at the same time, the management structure was changing. New people were coming into place at the top of these institutions that hadn't experienced things like, for example, the Great Depression, and didn't really work with people and savings and that sort of confidence at that level. They just started looking at other ways of making money. In the 80s, that became more complex, and banking got more deregulated in terms of what banks could do. By the time we got to 1999, as you mentioned, in the Glass-Steagall Act, which had been enacted to tame the banks during the Depression of 1933, and in fact had been embraced by the head of banks at places like Chase, which is now J.P. Morgan Chase, and National City Bank, which is now Citigroup. That had changed as well. And as the result of lots of swats against the Glass-Steagall Act, which had separated our deposits, our savings, our loans from these increasingly complex transactions that banks were able to do with our deposits and our loans as sort of the chips on their betting table to do that, they wanted more and more of that. And by 1999, under the Clinton administration, as a very enthusiastic bipartisan vote, where 90 senators voted in favor of repealing Glass-Steagall and merging banks back together, this created a sort of more free-for-all in the banking industry. And then you couple that with banks who didn't have deposits, like Goldman Sachs and Morgan Stanley and Merrill Lynch and investment banks at the time, and they said, you know what? Now these big banks have deposits. They've got chips on the betting table to do their speculative transaction with. What do we do? All right, we're going to borrow more money in order to do that, or something called leverage in banking. So they went to the SEC in Washington. They lobbied their congresspeople and so forth. They lobbied the Fed. And they basically said, all right, well, you can continue to borrow more and more against these more esoteric, complex securities because you don't have deposits. As a result of all of that, ultimately there was a mortgage crisis because we had a crisis first, a smaller one, a recession in 2001-2002. The remedy that the Federal Reserve had for that was to lower rates to 1.5%, and that gave banks cheap money with which to paper over the scandals that were happening during that recession from the energy sector and Enron, the telecom sector, and WorldCom. And they said, all right, great, we've got cheap money. Now what do we do? How do we change that into more money? Oh, we'll give subprime loans. And then we'll package those subprime loans into other types of securities. We'll sort of paper over any risk that they might have inside of them, and we'll grow and grow and grow those securities until we're basically lending them out, well, we're basically selling them to the rest of the world. And then we're also lending money to buyers of those toxic assets, as they became known to everyone, in order to buy more of them. And then we will make more of them. And then we will lend more to investors to buy them. And this whole cycle ultimately was never going to work, but that's what the regulators, going back to the Federal Reserve, the chief supposed regulator of the banking system, allowed to happen. And when the crisis happened, when the crash happened, they stepped in massively to help fix what they had watched become destroyed.
What struck you the most about how the Obama administration dealt with the 2008 financial crisis, especially how it dealt with banks?
So out of the 2008 financial crisis came something called the Dodd-Frank Act in 2010. And the idea of that act was to beat back some of the more egregious, risky behaviors of banks that they had undertaken in the run-up to the financial crisis. And somehow, by doing that, create a more healthy banking system, a more stable banking system, and something that wouldn't ultimately have to be bailed out again. However, what the Dodd-Frank Act didn't do is go back to the pre-Glass-Steagall repeal banking environment, which had actually been an environment in which less crises and less risk was imposed on the rest of the economy and the rest of people by the banking system. It never separated the deposit and lending activities of banks from the trading and speculative and concocting different types of complex assets and selling them on to the world aspect of banks. So as a result, we have this environment where the biggest banks are bigger than they were before the crisis. Part of that is because some banks went out of business and some banks took them over. One of my old employers, Bear Stearns, was taken over by another one of my old employers, J.P. Morgan Chase. Others like Goldman Sachs just grew because they were the recipients of sort of more friendly help from the government and from the Federal Reserve. It didn't hurt that they had a Treasury Secretary originally at the beginning of the crisis under the Bush administration and Hank Paulson, who had been the CEO and chairman of Goldman Sachs. But the point was that the Fed was a sort of silent partner in all this. So what the public saw was a bailout. And then the public saw Dodd-Frank as being touted to help create a situation where bailouts would no longer be necessary. The reality is, behind the scenes of all of that, throughout the Obama administration, as the head of the Fed went from being Ben Bernanke to being Janet Yellen, who basically followed the same policy, which was to lower rates to 0%, to keep rates close to 0%, and to sort of manufacture or conjure money within the Federal Reserve System to buy debt from these banks or buy Treasury debt that these banks got and sold back to the Fed, and effectively just manufacture money that did not go into the real economy. The narrative is that it has helped the real economy. But that's not what's happened. That started under the Obama administration. That is continuing now under the Trump administration with Jerome Powell, who's the current chair of the Fed.
Today we're speaking with former investment banker Nomi Prinz about her latest book, Collusion, How Central Bankers Rigged the World. Nomi will be speaking in Berkeley this Sunday at 7:30 p.m. at St. John's Presbyterian Church, 2727 College Avenue. If you're in the area, you can find more information at yourcallradio.org. And if you have any questions or comments for Nomi about the banking system and the economy, we'd love to hear from you. 866-798-8255. How are you impacted by the 2008 recession? It's very important to revisit what the administration did or didn't do, to talk about how the bailouts affected the banks and the economy. You can also email yourcall@kalw.org. And if you have any overall questions just about how the banking sector works, feel free to give us a call. Nomi, when you look at the 2008 bailout, where are we today? Is today's system still designed to protect the banks at any cost?
Yes, and it's also designed to ensure that, the stock market, which is one of the real level indicators that the Federal Reserve looks at, although that's not under their purview. I mean, that's really not under the things that they're supposed to be concerned with. That is connected also to having helped the banking system, or subsidized, really, the banking system. So, for example, today, and this is just a bizarre concept because this is very new in the last 10 years. The Fed has on its books about $4.4 trillion worth of securities, a lot of which were purchased in the years following the financial crisis. So starting in 2009 and going up through 2015-ish, other central banks around the world were coerced or colluded with or coordinated with, depending on how you look at it and what the events were on that given day, to do similar things in their areas. But focusing just on the U.S., because my book covers the globe, but the concept is the same, which is that if you create $4.5 trillion worth of money out of nowhere, and you basically pour it into the banking system, because that's just where it goes. You're not creating $4.5 trillion and purchasing a bridge project or a railway project or, you know, raising wages for any group of people. That is not what that money went to do. That money went to buy debt from the banking system at a time which they couldn't sell it or get rid of it in any other way. What that enabled banks to do is to appear healthier, because all of a sudden they get to get rid of their junk and they get to get infusions of cash from the central bank, which is supposed to be their regulator. It's also supposed to be their emergency lender of last resort, but it has become their emergency supplier of sort of every resort. And with that money, rather than ring fence any of it or put it aside or be required to deflect any of it to infrastructure, to small businesses, to community development, to individuals, to helping to forgive student debt, to helping people who are being foreclosed upon, to any of those types of more foundational economy uses, they did things like fix their trading potential losses, evaluate and value the assets they had left on their books higher. Because it's like if you have a garage sale and you have a bunch of like awful things in your garage, and like, you know, blenders that don't work and bicycles that don't have tires and such, and someone says, you know what, I'm just going to give you $100,000 for all of that. You know, all of a sudden you're feeling pretty good. You're like, you know what, I have this microwave that doesn't work either. Do you want that? And that's kind of what the banks were doing for a while. And then they moved on to doing something else, which is buying their own stock. So for example, last year, and I talk about this towards the end of my book, the head of the vice chair of the FDIC, which is the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation, that was designed in 1933 to protect our deposit had this very alarming analysis that he discussed with the Senate Finance Committee, which said that about 99% of the money that was going into banks at the time was being deflected, their profits, into stock buybacks. So ultimately, they used this money to buy their own stock. And again, if you're buying your own stock and you're getting money to buy your own stock and your regulator is saying it's okay because they do have to check with the Fed in order to buy back their own stock, and the Fed never says, no, hey, wait a minute, what about those small business loans, then they keep going. And so now we have a system where these banks remain subsidized by this money that is still kind of on offer by the Federal Reserve. And this is a phenomenon that's global in a lot of the major economies of the world.
Can you talk more about how buybacks work? After the Republicans passed their tax cut that mainly benefits the ultra-wealthy and corporations, and the New York Times has been doing good reporting about how corporations plan to buy back their stock. Apple, for example, this piece just came out yesterday, says it's going to buy back $100 billion in stock. Talk a little bit about how this works and why it's important to know about it.
Right. So also, I want to dissect a little bit. When Apple buys $100 billion of its own stock, it has kind of a lot of cash that it's choosing not to put into, developing the next, I-27 or whatever it might be, right? I mean, there's choices that they make in terms of what they want to do with their money, and in this situation, they've decided that if they can buy their own stock, they can get more. Well, first of all, they can raise the level of their own stock, which helps the sort of executives at Apple. It also helps pay dividends to the shareholders at Apple. It brings in more shareholders and so forth. So in a way, stock buybacks, which are perfectly legal, are a way in which companies can really boost the level of their own stock with their own capital, or they can borrow money to do so. In Apple's case, it was their own money. In the case of the banks, which is a very, very different use, because first of all, they were bailed out. Second of all, they had trillions of dollars of help. And third of all, they went and also did a lot of purchasing of their stock last year, and last year was a record buyback. For example, between J.P. Morgan Chase and Citigroup, they asked to buy back almost $35 billion of their stock last year, and they're asking to potentially do more of that this year. Just those two banks, so they've been able to really utilize money that really existed to help them and supposedly make them healthy in an emergency situation 10 years ago, and now they're using it to buy their stock. And then you add on to that the tax cuts, which actually the head of J.P. Morgan Chase, the CEO and chairman, Jamie Dimon, called them QE4. Now, QE is quantitative easing. That's the sort of wonky description of fabricating money out of nowhere as a central bank and buying whatever assets are out there with it so that they can basically give that cash easily to the banking system. And it's supposed to be used in abnormal situations like, major wars and, things like that. But obviously, it's still being used in this 10-year period. So when banks now use that money to buy back their shares, it's kind of like saying, okay, well, we screwed up the economy. We got a ton of money and help for it. We also are now getting tax cuts. So after three iterations of quantitative easing, of sort of buying lots and lots of our assets and having created lots and lots of money to do that with, QE4 is now our sort of prize for that, which is a major tax cut. So the last quarter results for these major banks, the big six banks made or saved, however you look at it, $3.6 billion just because of the tax cuts. So that is in addition to all the money they made by sort of boosting their own stock with all their subsidy money from the Fed and so forth. So that was just such an extra thing. And Jamie Dimon, who I don't agree with on a lot of things, called it right when he called it QE4.
Today we are speaking with former investment banker Nomi Prinz about her new book, Collusion, How Central Bankers Rigged the World. This is Your Call. We'll be back after this. This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Today we are joined by former investment banker Nomi Prinz. She's out with a new book called Collusion, How Central Bankers Rigged the World. She says that no significant regulations have been introduced to fix the structural problems after the 2008 financial crisis, and that means we are headed for another epic fail. The question is not if, but when. And you can join us if you have any questions or comments for Nomi. You can email yourcall@kalw.org. You can also give us a call, 866-798-8255. Before the break, Nomi, you said that the six banks saved about $3.59 billion last quarter from the tax cut bill. The AP had a lengthy story about this, and they report that the nation's six Wall Street banks posted record or near record profits in the first quarter. A Business Insider has CEO pay. Michael Corbat at Citigroup, $23 million. That's an increase of 48% from 2016. Brian Moynihan, Bank of America, Merrill Lynch, $23 million. Lloyd Blankenfein, Goldman Sachs, $24 million. And then you've mentioned Morgan Stanley, James Gorman, $27 million. What should we make of the massive profits and massive CEO pay? A lot of them are getting major bumps. How is this happening exactly?
It's happening because throughout this entire decade since the financial crisis, they have had a supreme amount of coddling by their sort of mother bank, which is the Fed. They've effectively they have paid some fines over the years for all of the crimes that they committed, both into the financial crisis and since the financial crisis. One of the big banks that's not headquartered in Wall Street, it's actually headquartered in San Francisco, Wells Fargo, but it's included in one of the big six banks. Just had to pay in a $1 billion settlement for basically faking insurance contracts for their customers in the auto and mortgage areas, and settled on that with the Department of Justice and the Consumer Financial Protection Board, which actually was created by the Dodd-Frank Act and was one of the best parts of that act, because it created another body to actually help consumers get their money back when it's stolen from them by these institutions. And the head of that bank, Tim Sloan, I think got an increase of about 37% or something last year as well, while that was all going on. And he actually came in before that off of the old CEO, John Stumpf, to clean up the mess that had accumulated apparently under Stumpf, even though he was working there at the time. So what all that means is that these men are making more and more money, for the most part, because their compensations are comprised of stock and options and some cash. Their salaries are more than the average salary, but where they really clean up is in the level of their stock and options. Now, if their stock is going up because they have a whole bunch of free money with which to buy their stock, and their regulator's saying, hey, by the way, we're just going to kind of keep this policy going, we'll tweak it a little bit, we might sell some of those $4.5 trillion of assets and get some of our money back, but it's not going to be coming back from the banks. It's sort of, it comes back in different ways. But so all of a sudden, their compensations in total are going up because they're getting free money with which to buy the stock that then comprises part of their compensation. So the fact that they are making more money is just a mathematical reality by virtue of money coming to them that they don't really have to pay for. So regardless of the health of their institution, regardless of whether they want to provide, for example, the depositors in their institution with more interest on the deposits that they keep with those institutions, they don't have to really bother to do that because they can just take that money, invest it in their own stock, have their stock go up, which in turn makes their compensation go up. And for them, that's a really good game. It's not so much of a great game for the depositors. And again, the Federal Reserve has allowed this, not only allowed it, has enabled this, has provided the capability for this to happen. And then you throw in tax cuts and everything else, and that just helps to create more money with which to buy more of their stock and inflate their compensations by that much more.
We're speaking with former investment banker Nomi Prinz about her new book, Collusion, How Central Bankers Rigged the World. We have a number of callers on the line. Let's go to Ralph in Palo Alto. Hi, Ralph. Welcome to the show.
Thanks, Rose. Yeah, my question for Nomi is about the role of naked credit default swaps in the last crisis and in the next crisis. And just a quick pressee is Goldman Sachs and John Paulson and Magnetar and a bunch of the outfits that made a ton of money in the last crisis did it with naked credit default swaps, which I'm sure Nomi can describe in better detail than I.
Thanks, Ralph.
Thank you for that, Ralph, because actually they come into play now as well for a slightly other reason that relates to these central banks. So to just give a sense for what a naked credit default swap is, because it sounds very sort of complicated. Not the naked part, but the credit default swap part, probably. But it just means there's no there. So if I say to you, I'm gonna basically insure the cost of your house and the fact that you can repay the mortgage on your house if it burns down and you have no insurance to begin with, that would be like a naked credit default swap. Because what I'm saying is, I kind of know that you might not be able to pay me back because you have no ability to pay me back in the event of that emergency. But I'm going to basically get someone else, once I protect you, once I basically do this naked credit default swap trade with you, what that means is I will pretend to insure you in that situation where I could potentially get no money back. But I will sell the value of that, which I'll just create. I'll just define that as having a value to somebody else. So then I'm kind of the broker in the situation. I'm out of that. And somebody else has just paid me to insure you for an event that, if it happens, will mean that that person who just paid me won't get paid. And basically what they did in the mortgage crisis was kind of that. John Paulson and all these guys worked with Goldman Sachs and other banks to make money by finding that third party to take on the risk of not just individual mortgages, because it was more complex than that, but collections of individual mortgages that weren't potentially doing that well. Because what happens, and this is like a ironclad rule on Wall Street, you can make more money creating a new kind of complex asset security thing if there's more risk to begin with in the proposition. So if a subprime loan is more risky to begin with, because it just is, and then we collect them into a sort of bundle of other loans, and then we sort of move them out throughout the system and sell them to other investors in different forms and sort of camouflage the weakness, then that's going to create a weaker and weaker system along the way. And that's kind of what happened. You're creating a house of cards that doesn't have a really good foundation, but every so often you're adding a card to the bottom, but like multiple cards to the top. And when that whole thing falls apart, it crashes the entire house of cards. And that's really what the credit default swap enables all of the players in this to do, is to make money by just, you know, covering things that they don't have to worry about failing.
How did Dodd-Frank deal with the credit default swaps?
not very well. There is a lot of language in Dodd-Frank that tried to say that, first of all, they continue to allow banks to be involved in credit default swaps. But the way they dealt with it was that they said if there is a kind of asset, a kind of security that's created that has risk in it, they have to set aside more money in the event that that fails. So the way that they dealt with it is they came up with a really small percentage of extra money that banks would have to set aside in the event that these more sort of risky propositions failed. They didn't restrict them from doing credit default swaps. In fact, now, these credit default swaps, which were attached to people's mortgages back before the financial crisis, are being sold in record amounts. This quarter was the record for the new type of risky security, but connected to corporate loans. So instead of individual loans relative to houses, it's now corporate loans relative to, you know, corporate health. And so the same thing is happening right now. It's just with, you know, it's like a new pie with, like, you know, not cherries in it, but now strawberries in it. It's the same principle.
Overall, what do you think of Dodd-Frank?
Overall, I think that by establishing the Consumer Financial Protection Board, which was, I think, the most important part of Dodd-Frank, it at least enabled a set of regulators, even though they don't have the power to regulate, but to at least extract money that is lost by individuals because of bank practices, and having more eyes on that and sort of more dedication to retrieving it. So in that respect, that was a good element of Dodd-Frank. I do not think that Dodd-Frank created a safer banking environment as the people involved in creating Dodd-Frank did, because there are loopholes to literally everything that Dodd-Frank tried to do in taming some of these risky practices. There's literally no practice that Dodd-Frank touches that doesn't have a loophole. And so that a banker can get around. It was like an 828-page document, and I had a piece about this years ago, but it was something like, you know, 42 pages of it actually were meaningful, and even those had loopholes attached to them, and the rest was sort of definitions where you'd have one definition about, you know, just because we talked about before, what a credit default swap is, and then you have another definition that says, well, yes, but if it's used in this particular instance, then it doesn't count. And so if you actually read the bill, it has a lot of negation of its own, of what could have been positive by virtue of the language that's in it. And the fact that banks have not caused another crisis in the last 10 years or in the last 8 years since Dodd-Frank was passed is not because they've been structurally reformed. It's just because they've had a lot of money to wash over potential problems and to use to reestablish themselves and to use to, you know, lift the level of their stock and to make analysts happy with them. And that just sort of has its own narrative.
Comments from California Republican Representative Kevin McCarthy signal that a deal could soon be reached between the House and the Senate to pass a rewrite on Dodd-Frank that would ease oversight on small and mid-sized banks. This is according to Reuters. What are your thoughts on that? And do you think that the administration will take action on Dodd-Frank?
Well, having just talked about what the problems with Dodd-Frank are, what the administration wants to do and what the Republicans want to do is make it even less effective. So despite the fact that there's loopholes and everything within it, you know, it was something. And I think now what's going to happen is by kind of pointing towards small and medium-sized banks as being overregulated and overburdened by some of the elements of Dodd-Frank that really should be actually even stronger for the bigger banks, such as putting aside extra capital for risky activities, such as creating what they call living wills and having a bank having to create a report or some sort of analysis on a regular basis that they provide to the Fed and say, if this happens, then we will deal with it in such a way so we avoid having a comeback to the government type of situation. So part of that bill that talks about helping small and medium banks actually is camouflaging the fact that it's also asking for the larger banks to be allowed to step out of some of the reporting that they should be doing in order to ensure that they're at least able to handle themselves in an emergency, which they're not, but now it's actually even taking away the pretense of them having to talk about that. Look, a small bank should not have the same requirements as a big bank in terms of setting aside capital. But the reason for that is simply because they're not doing the types of risky activities that these banks are doing. A local bank, a community bank that's providing money to small businessmen or small business women, not them physically small, but, you know, sort of localities is doing that in a way, if done properly, it benefits that local community, and that benefits the larger area surrounding that local community. And that benefits some money coming into a state and so forth. It's a way of solidifying the foundation of an economy, and that's what small and community and local banks can do. But this particular act doesn't really change that they do that. It just tries to get around what big banks need to be regulated for by kind of using small and medium banks as the sort of carrot to that.
After the crash, Nomi, we did a lot of shows about the Move Your Money campaign. A lot of people were closing their accounts with the big banks and opening them with small banks, credit unions, and community banks. Does that make a difference?
It does make a difference because the small and community banks, which also happen to have individuals in your community that you know. So if you have a small bank in a particular community and there's a teller there that happens to, you know, hang out and eat in restaurants or bars or whatever in that community, then everybody's helping everyone. And if you don't have that situation, you know, it's a lot harder to see that line. You also, in a smaller community bank, have bankers who know those businesses and know those people and can make decisions based on sort of real on-the-ground insight, as opposed to something like, you know, Wells Fargo or J.P. Morgan Chase that simply are able to collect real estate by virtue of the fact that they have all this money with which to do it on street corners and in local places and don't really care about the local communities because a lot of the money that they make from those depositors just goes into the sort of big pot with which they can do things like buy their stock or create, you know, credit default swap transactions or do all the other things that they do that are just sort of financial speculation that, that benefits them. And it doesn't necessarily benefit communities. So the more that we support or we move money or we look at the idea of local and community banks being real cornerstones of our economy, the more that they can be.
We're speaking today with former investment banker Nomi Prinz. Her latest book is called Collusion, How Central Bankers Rigged the World. And if you're in the Bay Area, Nomi will be speaking in Berkeley this Sunday at 7:30 p.m., 2727 College Avenue. Find more information at yourcallradio.org. We have an email from David who says, what would real banking reform look like?
That's a great question, David. So real banking reform would look like reducing the size of the big banks, not allowing them to control as many of the financial assets in the country as they do, capping the amount of deposits that they can have, splitting up the deposits and loans section of these banks from any types of speculation or creation of securities or fee-driven businesses so that we can actually have money that depositors put into a bank receive more interest and have that interest be used to provide more loans into people, into small businesses, into real economic development, infrastructure, and so forth, by bringing back a Glass-Steagall Act for this century. And also going back to the Federal Reserve, going back to central banks, which have this unlimited check writing ability to help the largest banks and don't help the smaller banks, first of all, retract some of that help, because then the banks would be smaller to begin with and they'd have to actually make decisions based on real economic and real individual and real business situations and not have this sort of free check writing ability, actually have an auditing of the central banks themselves, have a diversion if they do and can and are able to create some money, go into the small banks on a level that actually helps them more than it helps the big banks on a proportional basis, and actually look at creating more public banks, whether it's on the city level or whether it's on the state level, in order so that on a state level and on a city level, there's more money and funding available to actually solidify things on the ground. All of that would be major reform to the banking system, but it would also be very healthy for the foundation of our economy and of any economy.
We have an email from Howard who says, I quit teaching English at Union College in 1983 and became a stockbroker in New York City. I too learned about the system by observing it day to day. I'm excited to know that someone is explaining it to the general public. He says he'd like to ask you, Nomi, where the system is heading, massive inflation, collapse, and the nationalization of the banks, or something else?
I empathize with you for being involved in the stockbroking side and seeing it from the inside. In terms of where the system is going, it's not going in a manner, let's put it that way, that's going to create a situation where the big banks have less power than they do now. Unfortunately, and particularly in this administration right now, although it's happened in the last administration, it will probably happen in the next administration to an extent. It's not a partisan proposition. But the people that are at the head of the Federal Reserve now are more in favor of deregulating or reducing restrictions on banks than the administration beforehand, which already didn't do such a great job in the wake of the financial crisis, and the administration before that, the Bush administration, under which the crisis brewed. So where that goes is nowhere good. A financial crisis happens when the major financiers in the system, which happen to now be the big banks because they were allowed to stay big and grow, can't and won't even give money or trust each other. That's what happened in the financial crisis of 2008. So though they bought a lot of subprime mortgages and though they recreated them into all sorts of esoteric bells and whistles types of securities, when it crashed, it was because they wouldn't lend to each other. The banks that failed, like Lehman Brothers, like Bear Stearns, failed not because they were doing anything differently from the big banks that succeeded, you know, I say in quotes, but it's because they were lent money by these big banks. They couldn't pay them back, and the big banks wanted to protect themselves, and it was every banker for themselves in Washington trying to get bailed out and subsidized. That can happen again because we have not reformed the system. So there can be another financial crisis. When it happens, it will be because of all the debt that has been created throughout the levels of the economy that has been poured into the stock market from the major corporations and the banks, and that has been manufactured at its source from the Federal Reserve in many cases. And when that starts to deteriorate, they start not to trust each other again. They start to come back to the government and central banks for even more support than they got next time. I don't think we see a nationalization of banks for the reason that they're so politically connected to Washington. Mm-hmm. And even though this system is rife with risk and has shown itself to be able to implode and wreck economies and people's lives and sort of a globe, there's still a very strong group of powerful people who don't want to relinquish the status quo, which is why we need to establish more things from a foundation up, which is why, you know, we do look at local and community banks, of public banking options and that sort of thing to sort of take away at least some of the money, some of the deposits that are used as chips on this betting table for these institutions.
Do you see major differences between the parties? Because regardless of who's in power, inevitably someone from an investment bank is going to be the Treasury Secretary, right?
Right. No, I don't. I don't see any difference. I do see that right now we're going in more of a deregulatory pattern from a holding pattern in terms of how lax rules are relative to these large banks and how they have been since 1999 and even pushing into the 1999 repeal of the Glass-Steagall Act. But yeah, under Bill Clinton, a Democrat, you had a Treasury Secretary who was from Goldman Sachs and Robert Rubin. Under George W. Bush, you had a Treasury Secretary that was from Goldman Sachs. Under George W. Bush, Obama's second largest campaign contributor was Goldman Sachs, and he had a lot of advisors from Goldman Sachs during his administration. And Donald Trump has Steve Mnuchin as his Treasury Secretary, who was a senior partner for a long time at Goldman Sachs. So, you know, if you add that up, it would stand to reason that even if we have a Democrat president next, they're probably going to have a very senior economic advisor, Treasury Secretary, who's been through Goldman Sachs.
Naomi, we have a couple questions about inequality, and I just wonder how, I mean, when you look at where we are right now, you know, in California, so many people cannot make ends meet. 48 million people in this country are on food stamps. There's a lot of studies about how two-thirds of Americans would struggle to cover a $1,000 crisis. We have flat wages with so many contractors. People don't have retirement. They can't plan for the future. I mean, as you know, the list goes on and on. How does this world of bankers think about, because you still are in contact, you still give talks and you're in contact with these bankers, what do they say about the massive inequality that we're dealing with right now?
From a day-to-day business sense, they don't really talk about it, to be honest. When I spoke at the Fed in the summer of 2015, or the mid-year 2015, which was kind of how collusion came about, I was asked to talk about a set of a situation that relates to inequality, but it was, why isn't Wall Street giving money to Main Street? That was literally the topic of what I was asked to talk about at the Fed, and there were central bankers there from all over the world and so forth. And I just got up and I said, you know, they're not doing it because you didn't make them. I mean, you didn't make them. You gave them this whole pile of money, and that money went to the top. So today, for example, 10% of the country owns 84% of the stock market. So if the stock market is being bought by a policy that the Fed uses to provide banks with money with which they and their corporate friends buy stock, and then you add on to that tax cut so they can buy more stock, they are the ones that are benefiting. That increases the level of inequality. When you are not providing interest rates for people's savings so that if they're not in the stock market, they have nowhere else to go to even receive interest on their own money, that creates inequality. When you fabricate capital and you give it to banks rather than allowing it to go into the, or diverting it into the main economy because you decided not to, you could, it was an emergency, you could have done whatever you wanted as a Federal Reserve. You chose not to. You chose to give a substantial sum of money, a historic sum of money, into the banking system and not into the foundational economy. All of that increases the level of inequality. And in fact, the Fed's own study, they do this every 3 year study about inequality. So a new one will come out in 2019. But the last one that came out in 2016 literally showed inequality had increased under their policies. And yet they continued on with these policies. But when you give money to the top and it doesn't go to anyone else, and it just accumulates and accumulates at the upper levels of the financial ladder, it creates inequality as well. And then it's also not just internally within one country. The same phenomenon, because the Fed colluded with central banks throughout the world, is present throughout the world in countries and then between countries as well.
You know, we have time for one more caller who's been waiting patiently. We've got about 2 minutes. Let's go to Tom in San Francisco. Hi, Tom. If you can be brief, please.
2009, the government had a chance to nationalize the banks, but it looks like the banks nationalized the government again, and that seems to be the case. Would it have been cheaper to pay the bad mortgages off in 2009? Than to give all this money to the banks? And the next little tidbit is, if 2009 should occur again, 2008 should occur again, would there be enough confidence in the government that it can be effective functioning government? Thank you.
Tom, so when my book, It Takes a Pillage, specifically talks about, and I wrote in 2009, how if we had diverted the $500 billion that it cost to literally pay everybody's subprime mortgage, because that was what was in the system at the time, rather than what the banks did, which was use them to sort of stick into all these other toxic assets and then lend money on top of it. So they created this whole mountain of just stuff. That would have been far cheaper. That would have actually helped the banks as well, because the securities they created would have actually had money coming into them, because the subprime mortgages would have been financed or helped or subsidized. But instead, what was subsidized was this 10-year program that enables these banks to be healthy, buy their own stock, and all the things we were talking about. So absolutely, it would have been cheaper and better and healthier for individuals and the economy to have manufactured a fraction of what was manufactured, if you're going to go that route anyway, and use it at the base level of the economy. Keep people in their homes, keep the financial system more secure as a result, and it would have been a much cheaper way to go. That's not what happened. Mm. This is where we are now. We still need that kind of reform. If there's another crash, we're going to have the same thing happen. The Fed will manufacture more money. It will go into the same banks. Maybe we'll lose the bank and the other five will become bigger, but these are pretty much the six we're going with, and it will just continue.
Well, thank you for the call, Tom. Nomi Prinz is a former investment banker. Her latest book is Collusion: How Central Bankers Rigged the World. If you're in the Bay Area, she'll be speaking in Berkeley this Sunday at 7:30, 2727 College Avenue. Nomi, thanks for your work and thank you for joining us. We'd love to have you back.
Thank you so much, Rose.
Thank you. And thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's your call.